Hey, it's been a while. This is a three-part series on the Wright brothers. This is just going to be episode one. It'll count as 94. 95 will come out. That's part two. And then 96. Yeah, it'll be part three. These are from the March Patreon a while back. The show's still been going on Patreon. I've just taken time to do things like nunchucks for shoulder stability, trying to figure out my body. I don't know what to tell you. But anyway, check out the Wright brothers. Hope your Friday's going well. I'll talk to you later on. All right, I'll see you. David McCullough's The Wright Brothers, part one, helping out Frank Hamburger. All right, our story takes place from 1884-ish to 1920, and mostly in Dayton, Ohio. If you don't know where Dayton's at, it's about 50 miles north of Cincinnati. If you don't know where Cincinnati's at, middle of the country. Think Chicago-ish. Chicago's pretty far away, but that's the biggest city that's kind of close to Dayton. And if you live in Dayton, I'm not saying that you're nothing but Chicago. I'm just trying to paint a picture. But Ohio, if you've ever been out, that area, the Great Lakesy. I don't know. You know, not everybody knows exactly where everything's at. No disrespect to Ohio, obviously. Anyway, that's where our story takes place. Now, again, 1884 to 1920, what did Dayton, Ohio look like? All right, it was on the come up. They had a new hospital, new courthouse, new public library that was built to look like the Back to the Future public library with the big Roman columns and stuff. You know, like an impressive library. And they also had electric streetlights, which were brand new, and that was a big deal. Now, up until this point in time, the coolest thing that had happened in Dayton so far is that in 1859, Abraham Lincoln did give a speech there. But that was one time, and that was pretty much it. Not bad. Ohio at the time was really proud that the state had already produced three American presidents. So I looked up what three presidents there. I don't know many presidents from before. They all kind of blend together, except for like the Abe Lincoln and the George Washington. They do blend for me. So I looked up which three already came out from Ohio. They were, first off, William Henry Harrison, 1841. This dude was the first sitting president to have his picture taken, and he also died of pneumonia, making him the first president to die in office. Okay. All right. Next up, Ulysses S. Grant from 1869 to 1877. This guy supported amnesty for Confederate leaders and protections of the rights of African Americans. He also signed legislation establishing Yellowstone National Park as America's first national park. All right. John Muir would have been happy with that. And then the third one they already produced was Rutherford B. Hayes from 1887 to 1881. Now, this guy lost the popular vote, but he won the Electoral College by one vote after a ruling by an Electoral Commission. Okay, still counts. Still got in there. And then he signed a bill in 1879 allowing female attorneys to argue cases before the U.S. Supreme Court. All right, Rutherford. There we go. So up until now, I mean, Ohio as a whole was proud of that. Dayton had one speech from Abe Lincoln. There's room for more cool stuff to happen in this area. So here we go. Oh, and before we get going with the story, like 1884, life in Dayton, just a reminder, there's no TV, there's no internet, no cell phones, no landline phones. Most communication is done through written letter correspondence, mostly unpaved streets as well. It would soon become like a major manufacturing town, but, you know, it's not frontier America. It's a new town. We're doing better, but it's not far away from. We used to have to worry about bears at night, not joking around. So that's where our story starts. Our two main characters, Wilbur Wright and his brother, Orville Wright. All right. Wilbur was the older brother by 4 years, commonly known as the senior member of the partnership, and Orville was usually the better dressed of the two. Also the more serious, in large part, and he played the mandolin. Now, Wilbur was the more gregarious, and he was known to have talked with his hands. He played the harmonica and was known for having a great memory. but he would forget little things. So he was a guy who could remember something cool you guys did 8 years ago, but he would run out of the house and then be like, oh shit, where are my keys at? And then have to run back in. I mean, there were no cars. Oh, where's my hat at? Run back into the house, go get his hat, come on back. No car keys for like 40 years. Now, the brothers had a little sister named Catherine. She was younger by Orville by 3 years, and she was the most sociable of the three. So you had Wilbur's the top, Orville's the middle, Catherine's at the bottom, all separated by like 3 or 4 years, more or less. To round out the family, the dad was known as Bishop Wright. This is because he was a traveling Protestant preacher. Now, Bishop Wright actually grew up on the frontier. He was an outspoken abolitionist, and he also he didn't like secret societies. Specifically, was not into the Freemasons, especially with Freemasons like getting into his church. I'm not really sure how that early America social society worked. I think the Freemasons were much more, I don't know, they were, I think they were more like a force that was talked about. I'm not saying that they're not today, or perhaps they are a stronger force today who have hidden their dealings better. I don't know, but they're the Wright brothers' dad, not into Freemasons. Also, when I was reading the book, I messed this word up at least three times, and then because I read the book out loud into my phone to make my own audiobook so I can listen back to it to take notes. And so by the third time I screwed this word up, I was like, oh, come on, Chris, you got to look this up. So it's itinerant, itinerant, which is another word for traveling. But when I was reading it, I was like, iterant? Iterant. It became iterant in my head, and I had to slow down and look at these notes and spell it to say it correctly. Itinerant. It's a fancy way of saying traveling, because the dad was described as an itinerant Protestant preacher. Traveling preacher. He did road gigs. What was cool about this is that Bishop Wright would go on to see like a lot of early America, and then when he would come back to Ohio to talk and hang out with his kids, he would be able to tell his kids about the rest of America. He'd be like, I've been to California. You got to see this place. I've been to St. Paul, Minnesota. It's incredible. So that helped give the Wright brothers and their little sister, Katie, like a greater picture of like what's possible in the world and how big the country actually was. Before there was like internet and cell phones, you really had no idea. Now, the mother of the family, Susan Wright, she unfortunately passed away in 1889 when the kids were young from tuberculosis. She was known for an even temperament, kindness, and having an ultimate mechanical intelligence brain. It was widely thought that the Wright brothers' mechanical craft brain, intelligence brain, the brain that's always taking apart doorknobs, putting them back together, making their own toys, putting wheels on stuff, trying to make things fold down like Transformers just for fun, that is credited to the mother, Susan Wright. And when the kids were growing up, she made sure to save, not destroy, everything that the two brothers would ever make together. Like when they were little kids making toys together, trying to figure stuff out, instead of, you know, stepping on it, getting mad, throwing it out, yelling at things, she would pick it up and save it and put it on like a special shelf in the house to encourage the boys, like, oh, this is, I'm not sure what this is, but I like that you're doing this. Early childhood. All right, Wilbur, star athlete in school. Football, baseball, and gymnastics. Was an outstanding gymnast. Academically crushed school. By the time it was close to him finishing up high school, there was talk in the town that, like, you know, Wilbur might go to Yale. And it was, and that was a big deal. That was, you know, this is early Ohio. Somebody from the town going to Yale, that's big news, right? Okay. However, while playing pond hockey towards the end of high school, a neighborhood kid smashed out all Wilbur's lower front teeth with a bat. Okay, this kid, this was a kid, his name was Oliver Cook Hugh, or Haig. Oliver Cook, and if you want to look it up, H-A-U-G-H, right? Now this kid, he would go on to be executed in 1906, for the murders of his father, mother, brother, and 12 other people. Okay, now, at the time when this incident took place, Wilbur was 18 and Oliver Cook Haig was 15, right? Now, Oliver Cook Haig was known as the neighborhood bully. He would just always like to see other people in pain or hurt. But it was just a neighborhood bully, right? Nobody knew that they were dealing with this guy. And speculated, there's not a lot of information on this, but in a diary entry from Bishop Wright in like 1910, it was speculated that at the time of the incident, Oliver Cook Haig, he was working at a local drugstore, and he was known to have rotten teeth. And so the local druggist put him on medicine, but they don't know what kind of medicine it was. But the popular type of medicine at the time for a little kid with rotting teeth was cocaine toothache drops. So it may have been a 15-year-old future serial killer on coke who knocked out Wilbur Wright's lower teeth with a bat. That is a possible thing that happened. Okay, so trying to make the best out of a bad situation, Wilbur had to get false lower teeth. And he had some health complications from this incident. He was laid up in bed for weeks at the house. He suffered serious stomach problems and depression. Everybody was concerned, and all talk of Yale ended. Now, when Wilbur was laid up after that happened, his mom was looking after him. But unfortunately, her health was also starting to go. So as Wilbur would get better from the incident, his mom got worse. So when Wilbur was all the way better, his mom's health had fallen to a point where he just stayed in the house and started taking care of his mom. So like, she'd go downstairs by herself in the morning most of the time, but then he would hang out downstairs with her. But at the end of the night, she'd have so little energy from being so sick that he would carry her back upstairs. And then the next day they would just run the same play where like, mom goes downstairs by herself, we hang out, she's just kind of tired, don't make a big deal out of it, he'd carry her upstairs. Later on in Bishop Wright's diary, he said that like that time between Wilbur and his mom most likely gave his wife another like 2 years on her life because he was taking care of her like that. So during that time of this future serial killer knocking his teeth out and his mom getting pretty sick, Wilbur had become a recluse. He was a gregarious guy. Like, out of the two brothers, he was known for more going out and seeing people. But, you know, some things happen, so he had to stay in the house. So he had become a recluse. But to fill his time, he began reading. I mean, everybody in the family read, but specifically at this time, he started reading every book he could get his hands on. And they had that new public library, too, so I bet there was even more books he could go out. They said he just started reading like a demon. Okay, now, the house the family lived in was modest. It was on unpaved streets, and it had a nice wraparound porch on the front, but that had been built by the brothers early on. Now, the house was a couple blocks from the train station, which seemed convenient, right? But that means that they just always heard the train whistle. It was like having an apartment by the L train. Like, you just always hear that thing going. And the Wright brothers' house would constantly smell like coal because at the time you're dealing with Back to the Future type locomotives where it's like choo, 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 with those big puffs of smoke. Yeah, that would just go in the house all the time. So it's train whistles and everything stinks like coal, but you know, hey, you're out there. This used to be Frontier Town. We don't have to worry about bears because we got walls and doors now. This is an upgrade. There was also no running water or indoor plumbing until the brothers were in their 20s. Still, you know, overall house property worth about $1,800, which I tried to look up, and the closest I found was $2,000 in 1850 is roughly worth $73,000. So that's fine. That's pretty good. Okay, now, the one thing the house really had that was impressive that Wilbur had started digging into when his mom got sick, Bishop Wright kept a very large private library in the house. Now, the serious religious books were kept in his room, but the kids were allowed to read them if they asked. But the common area was filled with everything. Natural history, world history, Mark Twain, Darwin, two sets of encyclopedias. And both Bishop Wright and Susan encouraged the kids to read and think for themselves. That was the number one priority when the kids were coming up. So much so that the kids were allowed to decide whether or not they wanted to go to church at a certain point. I think they were like 10 or 12 years old. And Bishop Wright was like, look, you don't have to keep going to church. You can read these books and stuff, but I just don't want you sitting home doing nothing. If you stay home from church, I don't, you know, that's fine. It's your decision, but you got to keep moving, keep doing something. Again, the main focus of the parents when the kids were coming up, they wanted the kids to have active minds going as often as possible, and they stressed intellectual curiosity. 1889. All right, still in high school, Orville starts his own print shop in the backyard. He built his own printing press, like a screen printing press, using a tombstone, a buggy spring, and a piece of scrap metal. Homemade press. That's good. We're good. Now, he wasn't making this up out of whole cloth. Orville had had 2 years as an apprentice at a real print shop under his belt, so he knew the ropes, and he wanted to get it going. So with Wilbur back up on his feet now, you know, we're okay. Pond hockey's kind of out. We were getting bored of that anyway, dude. How about you just jump in on this with me? The brothers start a print shop at the house. They started a local newspaper. It's called the West Side News. Not a lot of hard-hitting information going on here, but again, it's early Ohio. What are you really going to write about? So some of the news stories, it was like, hey, what's going on? Who got arrested for stealing chickens? Who's got typhoid? And then some editorials from teachers they liked and were like, hey, you want to write something? So some teachers would come in, or they'd publish, you know, little snippets of, you know, poetry or Herman Melville or Dickens, something like that. It just round out a paper. It's a local paper. The boys are printing it, you know. Now, the paper made enough money to rent a space after a little over a year. So it went from, like, we're doing this at our house to, oh, we actually have a space to be doing this, which is cool. At this point in time, Orville's high school friend, Paul Lawrence Dunbar, was like, hey, what are you guys doing over there? Now, Paul Lawrence Dunbar was the class poet, which I think was a thing. I don't know if that was like class president back in the day, but that's what they said he was known as. That he was, I'm not sure if everybody wrote poetry or if they elected, or if they just knew that like this was the best poet we have. Anyway, so Paul Lawrence Dunbar was that. He was also the only black student in the school. So he comes over and he's like, hey, what's up? Can I jump in on this with you? And the brothers are like, yeah, dude, get in here. So the three of them started doing a weekly paper, like aside from the regular West Side News, for the local black community. That's awesome. Dunbar would then go on to become a nationally acclaimed poet. So, you know, that's pretty great. All right, 1894, after 5 years, the paper came to an end. Ran its course. What are you going to do? And then the brothers, they kept screen printing, though, but the personal, all the effort of making your own newspaper, they kind of left that aside, which was a good experience, but, you know, you got to move on sometimes. So they kept printing, like, side jobs or other people's jobs to make money, but that was the end of the West Side News. Right around this time, bicycles becoming huge in America, right? Most of the nation's doctors thought they were great for overall health. There was pushback, though. Some people thought it corrupted the youth. Listen to this, right? Because here's the reason being, people were like, kids can travel too far too fast now. Because it was only walking and running up until then. And if you're on a bike and you're hauling for like 15 minutes, you can get you can go a couple miles. That was like time travel back in like 1890. If you could get like a couple miles away in 15 minutes, they were like, damn, did you hit a portal? How'd you get over there? So people were concerned at how fast the young people could skate around. They also thought that nobody's reading anymore because they're all out there riding bicycles, right? So in 1893, Wilbur and Orville, like as the West Side News print press business was kind of dying down, Wilbur and Orville were like, all right, we got to get in on this. Because they both liked riding bikes. And they were like, let's take it to the next level. They opened their own bike repair shop. It was called the Wright Cycle Company. And it went okay. They both have mechanical brains, so they could do basic bike repairs. I mean, Orville built a print press out of a tombstone, a buggy spring, and a piece of scrap metal. Like, they could, not that bikes aren't complicated, but early bicycles, I feel like these guys could have nailed that, right? I feel like they have the natural talent to start one of these. People know them. They kind of know Wilbur's supposed to go to Yale. This is nice. Own business. Let's go. Anyway, I don't got to explain it for him. It's a great idea. Wilburn, Orville, Wright Cycle Company, getting it going in 1893. By 1894, competition causes the bike repair shop sales to slump. Neither brother feels very good about the business. Neither brother was very good at business. Because it wasn't stressed that the father, Bishop Wright, didn't really hammer home heavy sales and money and stress the business. And it's not like they had contempt for people who were good at business either. Both of them recognized, and this is in the book, that, look, some people are good at business, man. You know? And they move the world forward in a way. We are not that. Like, both of them recognized to each other that, like, okay, I don't know how we're going to do this, but I don't think that regular, like, business and sales, I don't think that's going to be us, you know? But, I mean, Wright Cycle Company's doing okay. But the business was slumping, and both brothers know that, like, I don't know, we to out-compete, I mean, there's just more bike shops, man. You know, we do good repairs, but everybody does good repairs. I don't know what to do. Wilbur specifically felt trapped, and he had to come up with a plan to make a future. But somehow bike repair sales did pick up, you know, local reputation. They had a paper. People know them. So they do move to a larger building. And at this larger building, the brothers decide to manufacture their own bicycles. They're like, this could set us apart from other bike repair shops and other shops that sell other people's bikes. If we make our own bike and it's really good, maybe we got a shot at a competitive advantage in a free market here. So the brothers invent the Van Cleet. And this was a bike named after their great-great-grandmother, who was the first white lady to move to Dayton. I don't know however far back great-great-grandmother goes. It's got to be so far back. Although people only lived like 30 years at the time. I didn't do the math on that. I just thought of an interesting question, and I didn't think to look into it before I did it. I'm not sure. Anyway, the Van Cleet, popular due to quality construction. Okay. Business picks up, and the Van Cleet gets some positive press reviews in bike magazines, and overall, Wilbur feels a little bit better about the future, like, oh, thank God we did something, because I was not going to Wally Loman my way out there into success, dude. We are not salesmen. Thank God we did something different. All right. Now, Bishop Wright, the father, was big on water quality. It was a common fear. He was always scared of somebody in the family getting typhoid. Medicine at the time wasn't great. 1896, Orville gets typhoid. 105 fever. And at the time, Bishop Wright's on the road. So Wilbur writes to Bishop, to his dad. And he's like, yeah, Orville's got typhoid. Okay? It's bad. So Bishop Wright writes back like a super serious, concerned dad letter. It's like, you sponge him off gently. Keep him comfortable. Coming home as soon as I can, right? So, to help Orville during typhoid, Wilbur starts reading books to him, like by the bedside. Wilbur starts specifically reading an aeronautics book, which is what they called, like, I don't know, they might still call it that. I have no idea if that term changed. Aeronautics may be actually what they call the study of flight, but it's definitely what they called it back in 1869, because that's when this book that Wilbur started reading to Orville was from, and it was by a German scientist named Otto Lilienthal. Okay, this German scientist and his younger brother had tried to achieve human flight by studying animals. So Wilbur's by Orv's bedside, and he's reading him this book about this German dude and his brother who were like, I think we could fly, I'm basing it on animals. Now, the German brothers had designed and built what they called sailing machines, which look like gliders today. Now, the brothers would pilot the sailing machines by hanging in the middle of the underneath. You ever see like a hang glider? It was sort of like that, but so much more dangerous. Hang glider today, they put you in like, it looks like a cocoon or a chrysalis. And then you're like, you're definitely strapped in a bunch of different ways. It's still pretty dangerous today. I've never been hang gliding. I got really no interest in it. It feels kind of unsafe. And it was definitely unsafe back in the day, because that's what these guys, I feel like these dudes were just kind of doing a pull-up in the middle. Hopefully, I think they hung by their waist here. Anyway, the German brothers' plan with their sailing machines aka early hang gliders, was get up on a steep slope. Okay, we're going to run down the slope into the wind. Here we go. And then when once they were up in the air, they would swing their body left to right as a means of steering the contraption. They had to have had, you got to put your hips on that bar. There's no way you're strong enough unless you are a champion gymnast. I mean, people were strong back then, though. Just living was like working out back then. He might have been doing a full pull-up. I haven't looked up. There's no way. I bet I bet there's a couple where you transition from like pull-up to pull-up and then on the hips. I bet these guys had all sorts of techniques. Anyway, they would get up in the air and it was wiggle time to try not to crash. So dangerous, man. All right. Now, one thing that was cool about this book that Wilbur was reading to Orv is that it had photographs of the German brothers' sailing machines in action. Now, Otto specifically, he was the one, the two brothers that would fly, and he was known as the Daring Flying Man. Okay, now in 1894, Otto Linenthal had crashed, but he lived to tell the tale, right? However, in 1896, he crashed again from a height of about 50 feet, and then he died of a broken spine. It was dangerous. Everybody knew this was dangerous. But the brothers were inspired, okay? All right, this sounds good. We got, you know, Orville's sick. He's got typhoid. He's playing with house money at this point. If he gets better, he was supposed to die. You know, why don't we give this a whack? You know, the brothers are inspired. Here we go. So the brothers start reading everything they could find about animal aerial locomotion. Now, people tried to figure out human flight before. Not just the German brothers of the Linenthals. But it was a popular thing to try to figure out if you had some money or you had some, you know, if you thought you could take a whack at it. So much so that, like, there was popular stereotypes around the world of people who tried to figure out human flight, they were ridiculed. People would say stuff like, land is for feet, water is for fish, air is for birds. Brothers didn't care. Come on. Orv's playing with borrowed time here. Wilbur got his teeth knocked out by a baby serial killer on coke. What else are we doing? Come on. The brothers became obsessed with the puzzle of human flight. Meanwhile, bike shop's going well. 1897, they moved to an even larger building, the Van Cleet, selling pretty well. Now the new shop, it's got two stories, showroom downstairs, machine shop powered by a gas engine, and it also led to an office in the back. Now on the second floor, there's extra workspace. Nice, everything you could ask for. However, 1898, a huge flood crushes Dayton. 2,000 people have to abandon their homes. Now it almost gets the new shop. The brothers come out, everybody's out on the street piling sandbags trying to save whatever part of Dayton they can save. The brothers end up saving the new shop barely. They said if the water had risen another 4 inches, the brother's shop would have been totally flooded and that would have been it. But they save it by about 3 or 4 inches of water. Also, as the flood's happening, they help a local hardware store owner carry barrels of nails from the basement of his hardware store up the steps out because it was going to get flooded. And the guy's whole stock was in his basement. Nails were all, like, you know, that's a hardware store back in the day. Nails are one of your number one products. They're going to get flooded. They're going to get rusty. You're going to be bankrupt. You're going to have no money. The Wright brothers were like, let me get in here. Owner of the hardware store, Frank Hamburger. Real name. Real name. I had to look. I didn't, when I read it, I said, I was like, Frank Hamburger? It was like, this is fake, dude. There's already so many crazy things that happened in this book so far. When I hit the Frank Hamburger name, I was like, this can't. So I at least had to look up, because I was worried that it would be too ridiculous if they helped save a hardware store owned by Frank Hamburger, who was also the man who invented the hamburger. So, you know, I had to look this up. Okay. The person who actually invented the hamburger, well, nobody really, it's attributed to various other people, okay? People give credit to a dude named Charlie Nagreen, Charles and Frank Menches, Oscar Weber Bibley, dude named Fletcher Davis, or Lewis Lassen. White Castle traces the origin of the hamburger to Hamburg, Germany, with its invention by Otto Krauss. Okay, so nobody really knows who invented the hamburger itself, but one thing's for sure, it was not this hardware store owner in Ohio named Frank Hamburger, which I am happy about, because if I look that up, and if this book went on to have another chapter about how Frank then went on to invent the hamburger and help the brothers out, I would have still done it, but I would have felt, I would have thought about sending an email to Dave McCollum being like, yo man, this is too much. Or maybe it's just the contrast of coming off of doing Endless Night, where there's 12 chapters of character building, and there's just so much has already happened in this book. To hit Frank Hamburger is a little much. Anyway, so flood happens. Not good for 2,000 people. Brothers help save the city. Also, hardware store owner makes out better than he thought he would. All right, at this point in time, Wilbur pens a letter to the Smithsonian Institute, because they're serious about this human flight thing. Wilbur's like, hey, me and my brother are making a run at human flight. We're serious. If you could get a second, could you please send me a reading list of what you think would be helpful in this pursuit? P.S. We are enthusiasts, but not cranks. Also, we own a bike shop. Thanks, Wilbur. I thought it was cool that he added the bike shop thing there. I mean, that's obviously not how it was written, but he made sure to put in that they had like a separate business. You could hear that he didn't want to be considered a crank due to the stereotype of the people who pursue human flight. So he just wanted to slide in like, oh, by the way, I got a real job. Like, we're not, I mean, we are going hard at this, but we do have you heard of the Van Cleet? Don't feel bad if you didn't. It's a kind of an Ohio thing. It's a nice bike. I got a real job, man. I'm just saying, but also, do you have a reading list? Because we are going to go up there. All right. The Wright brothers are not the only people going after human flight. Other serious inventors were also pursuing the idea at the same time. Famous guys. Thomas Edison was taking a whack at it. Alexander Graham Bell. Hiram Maxim, who I didn't know. Hiram Maxim is a dude who invented the machine gun, right? So this guy had money at the time. He spent $100,000 on a steam-powered flying machine, and it crashed immediately. $100,000 is $3.5 million in today's money. Now, magazines would publish failed attempts, which were very popular with readers. That's tough for Hiram Maxim. Oh, man. Now, these articles of published failed attempts would drive home the widespread belief that human flight is impossible and it's a waste of time. People thought it was like that Red Bull Flutog. I don't even know if they still do that with COVID and stuff, but remember, like, I don't know, maybe 10 years ago, I think they did it up in Manayunk. They probably did it all over the place, but people would build their own private gliders and then just jump off into the water, and the one that went farthest. That's what people would make fun of. Scientists who would risk their lives trying to do this, they would just be like, Red Bull flute dog. Come on. Anyway, stereotypical belief, human flight possessed, this is another one. This reminded me of Inception, that DiCaprio movie. There was a belief that once the idea of human flight possesses a person's mind, it can make them go insane. It's all they'll think about. Now, far as public opinion goes, there was a hierarchy of respect in the public sphere for scientists who are willing to go after it, though. Okay, scientists who just talked about it and published numbers and figures and tables and charts and theories were ridiculed. Whereas people who talked about it but also tried it were also ridiculed. But because they tried it, they were respected to an extent. Because people knew that it was deadly. They would make fun of it on the surface real hard. But if they knew that somebody was out there, like Otto Lilienthal and those German brothers, I mean, people made fun of them, but also nobody was out there trying that on their own. There's a level of respect that the public had. Like, if you got on one of those things, win, lose, or draw, in the hierarchy of people trying to achieve human flight, like, look, you got to give it to him, okay? He got on that thing, all right? and you know what can happen. Now, brothers ended up going up against people with more money, resources, and education, and they were risking public ridicule and possible death. However, in America, the times were good overall for new mechanical inventions. You know? The Kodak camera had come out, the Singer sewing machine, Otis had invented the elevator, that was new. People were like, what, stairs are in the past, check this out, I'm levitating. America had good new mechanical invention energy going. You know, which if I was one of the brothers, I would believe in voodoo like that. And when stuff was going bad, I'd be like, dude, I'm telling you, look at this. It's moving around. It's moving around. You know, look at that. They got the sewing machine going. Somebody's going to get up there. Why not us? Come on. We can get up there. Look at that. Look at the elevator. Look at that thing go up. Somebody's going to fly, man. Why not? Come on. Now, the Wright brothers believe birds were the key to the puzzle. They figured if birds can do it, we can figure it out. Now, the French aeronautics book by a French scientist named Molignard was very important to the brothers. It detailed the flight of the vulture specifically. Molignard would go to North Africa and just go into the desert and stare at vultures, just being like, how the fuck? Look at them go. Just out there alone. Look, nobody's saying the stereotype of the guys who go after this type of stuff are a little out there. They do stuff like go in the desert and stare up at vultures like, I don't even, how is this? Whoa, man. Molignard spent hours doing that, and then he wrote a book about it. What he had observed is that the flight of the vulture is often effortless. He rises and floats at will. Like a vulture sails on the wind like a ship in the ocean. He uses no force, no muscular effort. And so for the Wright brothers, using this vulture-based information by the French scientist Molignard, the brothers set about, it's time to build the first glider kite. I think we could do this. Let's base it off the vulture. We got a bike shop. We got machine shop. Gas-powered engine. We can figure this out. Let's go, dude. Now, the brothers broke down the project into the forces at play that they need to consider for a chance at success. They were, number one, balance, pictured by the brothers as similar to that of a bicycle rider. So they're picturing their flying machine in the air. What are the forces we're going to have to master for this to have a chance at working? First one out, balance, and from being bicycle shop owners and manufacturers, that's how they likened it to. You got to be able to balance up there. Second up, lift. This came from air moving faster over the top of an arched wing, thereby making the pressure on the top of the wing less than that of the pressure under the wing. We did the theory of flight on a public episode. Yeah, the airfoil. They didn't call it an airfoil, but the Wright brothers figured that out based on vulture information. They were like, yeah, dude, air moving over the top, less pressure, more pressure under the wing. There we go. We got bicycle balance plus pressure under the wing gives lift. Okay, we're figuring it out. Third up, pitch. This is the tilt of the flying machine. Front and back, nose down, nose up. So that's how you judge at the front of the machine versus the back of the machine. You're trying to look up, you're trying to look down. That's force number three, that's pitch. Next up, you got roll. This is the rotation of the wing. Two sides, left and right, up and down. And the brothers pictured it the way that a boat would be rocking on the ocean. So like left, right, boat's going, where we go, choppy seas, right? That's roll. Next up is yaw, which is overall direction of the flight. Like, which way are we going? We going north, we going south, and yaw also includes the turning of the flight, left or right. Now, the most important of the forces, for the brothers at least, they thought this was the key, is equilibrium. The brothers believed the trick wasn't getting up into the air. A lot of other people had gotten up into the air. Hiram Maxim's $100,000 steam-powered engine got up into the air, okay? And then it crashes. The trick to this whole thing was staying in the air once we get there. And you can only do that by establishing equilibrium once we're in the air. Now, the brothers had talked about that the German scientist who had died in 1896, Otto Lilienthal. Okay, that guy was trying to establish equilibrium, aka the ability to stay in the air, by shifting his body left and right, you know, modulating from pull-up to waist on there, pull-up. So dangerous, dude. I can't believe that worked even once for that guy. Wilbur's observation of birds in flight gave him the idea of maintaining equilibrium by using the tips of the glider up and down, because that's the same way that a bird uses the tips of its wings to shift and maintain flight in the air. Again, they're just going off watching people who can do it, aka birds, and being like, how are they doing that? And going off other people like Molyneux, who spent hours watching vultures, being like, how are they doing that? And just trying shit. So Wilbur's like, I'm telling you, let's go tips of the glider. Why not? This was a huge innovation. Nobody had figured this out yet. So they decided to use tips of the wings to try to maintain equilibrium and flight in the air. Also, after discovering this, Wilbur believed that this project was going to be a skill game. In that reality, there's two different parts of this project that the brothers were going to have to figure out. One, they got to invent a flying machine that works. It's got to get up into the air, and it's got to stay up in the air. But that's not the whole thing, because there's a second part, which means one of the brothers, at least one of them, has to learn how to be a pilot. You have to learn how to be a pilot of a flying machine that doesn't exist because you haven't built it yet. So really, this is a twofold task here. Understanding what they're looking at a little bit better, the brothers begin construction on the first manless test glider kite. Now, they weren't going to ride this one. This was just to test the wingtip equilibrium theory. It was a biplane, which means two levels. The pilot would be on the ground using two sticks attached to a flying cord. So this was like a huge kite, but as big as they could make it, because if this works, then we're going for it. Now, the pilot on the ground with the two sticks attached to flying cords. Those cords were connected to the tips of the glider's wings. This allowed the pilot to shift the wings up and down once the glider kite tester was up in the air. This would control the flying machine in midair, hopefully achieving equilibrium using the vulture bird wingtip theory that Wilbur had. Okay, let's give it a go. First test, early August, field outside of town. Good news. Got airborne. Wingtip idea worked. That's huge. But flying machine then nosedived, almost hit some kids. Big win. Big win. Wingtip idea worked. That's it. Look, it's imperfect. Kids almost got hit. Doesn't count. This is a success. This is good. It's on. The brothers begin building a glider big enough to hold a person. They're going for it. Wilbur writes to the Smithsonian asking for ideas on the best locations in America because for steady winds to test a full-sized flying machine. Now, wind was essential because they were still patterning it off the vulture. Molyneux said the vulture sails on the wind like a boat in the ocean. They need wind. If you're a boat, you need water. Brothers asking the Smithsonian, where can I find the most wind, which will count as our water? I hope they didn't phrase it like that because they were not getting a response back from the Smithsonian. All right. Smithsonian gets a letter. They huddle up with the National Weather Bureau. They then provide the brothers with monthly wind velocities from over 100 Weather Bureau stations from all around America. The National Weather Center in D.C. doesn't tell them what to do, but recommends number one, Kitty Hawk, North Carolina. Now, the brothers get this information, and they're like, all right, never been, and the farthest the brothers had ever been from Ohio was a one-time trip to Chicago. But look, they're going for it. They got the wingtip. This is all based on vultures. Again, Orville almost died. Wilbur with the teeth thing. What are we not going to go? We're going. The brothers write to Kitty Hawk. The postmaster from Kitty Hawk responds, hey, great pick. Love hearing from you. Come on down. Climate's healthy. You can find room and board. Or if you want to camp outside, that's also cool. You do that easily. If it was me, you're looking for steady winds, I would recommend September 15th to October 15th. That's your best bet. Wait until November, maybe tough. If you decide to come and try your flying machine here, I'll help you however I can. Honestly, I'm looking forward to it. This sounds pretty cool. Nicest postmaster in the world. Brothers, get that back. Kitty Hawk felt like the move. All right, by the final week of August of that year, the full-sized glider was almost complete. Now, they needed like a couple long pieces of pine that they couldn't find in Dayton, and they figured they'd be able to find it at Kitty Hawk or somewhere around the way once they got there. But it's except for like two long pieces of wood that they needed, it was all the way done. So they packed it up, the glider, the tools, and they had a new camera to take pictures because they wanted to more or less tape their set so they could watch it afterwards and see what they did right, did wrong. They're being as smart as they can about it. Wilbur decides to go first to establish camp. Orville, the glider, and the tools would arrive a few days later. And the Wright brothers would have their first man test of their flying machine at Kitty Hawk. All right, this is the end of part one. We'll have part two later this week. Thank you guys for listening to the show, and I'll talk to you later on. All right, I'll see you.